So Don Quixote's topsy-turvy views. The seed for this talk was sown at Pamaloka, which is, for those who don't know, it's a retreat centre for men just outside Norwich. And I was on a walk with Padmavadra, who's a senior order member in our order and a friend of mine. And I was talking about Don Quixote, the novel, just because I love it so much. I think it's my favourite novel. I've just started reading the third translation of it. So I've never read it in the original Spanish, but I'm reading the third translation of it, and I just can't get enough of it. And Padmavadra basically said that Sangharakshita, so the founder of our order and movement, had wanted to do something about Don Quixote and the topsy-turvy views. So Padmavadra mentioned that, and it just sparked me off, you know. So I've been thinking about that for some time, so this talk comes from that conversation. So I'm going to start just by talking a bit about what the topsy-turvy views are. Some of you will be familiar with this term. So the word is viparyasa. So it's a very traditional list, one of the many lists of the Dharma. Viparyasa, topsy-turvy view. And there are four of them. This goes way back to the Pali Canon, the early sort of texts of Buddhism. And the topsy-turvy views are seeing the ugly as beautiful, seeing the impermanent as permanent, seeing the insubstantial as substantial, and seeing the unsatisfactory as satisfactory. So it's basically it's the three marks of existence, which Mudita Shri called the facts of life, which I thought was very, very good. So it's those marks of conditioned existence plus something about beauty. So those are the viparyasas, seeing those things upside down, if you like. And so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give a few scenes from Don Quixote, the novel, and to illustrate those topsy-turvy views. And also, I'm going to talk about Shantideva. Often I stand up and talk about what I'm interested in, but it's important to talk about the theme as well, I think. So I will talk about the theme, I hope, as well. The theme is Pranya, wisdom. So I'm going to say a little bit about Shantideva and the context for that. Okay. So I want to say a bit about the novel first, though. Well, there's a few things you could say about Don Quixote. It's a very old novel. So the first part was published in 1605. The second part was published in 1615. Some people say it's the oldest novel. That's not entirely clear, but it seems to be certainly the first modern novel. The first novel we would say is a modern novel as we would understand it today. Another thing to say might be obvious. It's a comedy. It's a comedy of a middle-aged man who basically goes mad from reading too many tales of chivalry. So he reads all of these knight tales, these tales of knights, and he goes a bit mad. And basically he goes forth and decides he's going to become a knight. So he's going to become a knight-errant. And this is after knights, knights aren't really around anymore. But he's read all these books and he thinks, well, I'm going to do that. I'm so inspired by that. So he basically becomes a freelance knight, a knight errant. It's great, and somehow he manages to persuade his neighbour Sancho Panza to accompany him on these adventures that he goes on. So Sancho Panza goes as his squire, so like his manservant. So that's a little bit about the book. And just to say, these tales of chivalry. They were very, very well known at that time. There's so many books, tales of chivalry at that time. And obviously they're still familiar to us now as well. We think of King Arthur, the Knights of the Round Table. So it's a very, very strong tradition at that time, even stronger than now. I was thinking the equivalent for us now might be the detective novel. So even if we don't read detective novels, we just know what they are. We know the form very, very well because they're so widespread. But yeah, I'll just say a few words about the tales of chivalry that Don Quixote was reading, just some of the elements. So the knight always acts for his lady. So there's, you know, there's you know, we think of Queen Guinevere, for example, and the knights go out and they serve their lady and their princess. Sorcery and magic are an element. You know, we know about Merlin. So you know, sorcery, magic is a part of these tales. It's probably all very, very familiar. And then these bands of knights riding around, you know, righting wrongs. So that's just a little bit of background to that world. Basically, what Don Quixote does is he takes all of that literally. So he reads these books, and he just takes it all literally. So if it's in a tale of chivalry, then he thinks, yeah, well, that's real, that's true. If it's not there, then he thinks, well, it can't be true. You know, that's how he, that's his whole world, basically. So yeah, just to give an example of one of the early adventures. I can't remember whether Sancho Panza is with Don Quixote. Yeah, no, he is actually. This early adventure, they go to an inn, so they're on the road. Don Quixote on his horse, Sancho on his donkey, they're on the road. And they come across this inn, but basically Don Quixote thinks it's a castle. So they have a very nice evening there. And in the morning, they just sort of leave. And the innkeeper comes out and says, well, no, you have to pay. But because Don Quixote thinks it's a castle and he's never ever read of a knight paying for a knight's lodging. He just doesn't agree, you know, just doesn't understand this. This is what he says in the book. He says, in truth, I thought this was a castle and not a bad one. However, since it is not a castle but an inn, what you can do now is forgive the debt, for I cannot contravene the order of knights errant, about whom I know it's true, not having read anything to the contrary, that they never paid for their lodging. So that's what happens, and he rides off. And Sancho is often gets the sort of bad side of things, really. So what happens in this adventure is basically the innkeeper and the other guests get Sancho and they put him into a blanket and they basically just chuck him up in the air quite a number of times, and that's the sort of punishment for not paying. So, you know, you can really feel sorry for Sancho. But that's just an example of the literalism. So Don Quixote's mind, he just thinks this is a castle, don't need to pay, you know, what's the problem? Okay, so, yeah, I'm just going to go through the Papyriasas, these topsy-turvy views, and just give a few more examples of the wonderful world of Don Quixote. So the first Papyriasa is seeing the ugly as beautiful. So as I say, in tales of chivalry, it's very important to have a princess. So when Don Quixote decides to go off as a knight errant, he has to have a princess. And so there's a woman who lives in a local village. I don't think he knows her very well. He's seen her, and he just decides that, well, she's my princess. There's not much more to it than that, I don't think. Her name is Aldonza, which doesn't mean much to us, but it's supposed to be quite a sort of comic name. And I was thinking what an equivalent would be, and I was thinking Mildred might be a good name, actually. I don't know, there's a comedy series from the 70s, George and Mildred, so it's a sort of comedic name. But he doesn't call her Aldonza, he calls her Dulcinea del Toboso, because that's a bit more like it, isn't it? Dulcinea means sweet one, so that's his princess. He has his princess, and this is how he describes Dulcinea. Her name is Dulcinea, her kingdom Toboso, which is in La Mancha. Her condition must be that of princess at the very least, for she is my queen and lady, and her beauty is supernatural. For in it one finds the reality of all the impossible and chimerical aspects of beauty which poets attribute to their ladies. Her tresses are gold, her forehead Elysian fields, her eyebrows the arches of heaven, her eyes suns, her cheeks roses, her lips coral, her teeth pearls, her neck alabaster, her bosom marble, her hands ivory, her skin white as snow. And the parts that modesty hides from human eyes are such, or so I believe and understand, that the most discerning consideration can only praise them but not compare them. I mean, I just think that is comic genius. It really is absolutely fantastic. So that's Don Quixote's view of his princess. One thing to say is, so Dulcinea is not ugly. It says in the novel that she's actually very attractive. But clearly she doesn't live up to Don Quixote's view of her. So immediately we have sort of two levels of beauty in the novel. There's another brilliant adventure later on into the second part where Sancho just gets a bit tired of going on errands and getting into scrapes with Don Quixote for obvious reasons, I think. And at one point Don Quixote asks Sancho to take a message to Dulcinea. I mean, they don't really see her through the whole novel, but Don Quixote says, "Will you take a message to my lady?" And basically Sancho is pretty lazy and he's quite tired by this point. So what he decides to do is just basically find the first peasant girl that he comes across, and he's going to say to Don Quixote that basically that she is Dulcinea, but she's been enchanted, so she doesn't look like Dulcinea, you know. So this is Sancho's plan. It's a great plan. And in that case, the description is that the peasant girl that he comes across is ugly, and and she reeks of garlic to the extent that when Don Quixote finally does talk to her, he almost faints. So that's how it's described. It's sort of quite interesting. I think what I take from this in terms of the topsy-turvy views is, I think we can look at it as levels of beauty and levels of reality, if you like. I think it's quite an interesting illustration of seeing the ugly as beautiful, because, you know, Don Quixote does believe Sancho. He does believe that this is Dulcinea, that she's been enchanted, and, you know, so he's projecting the sort of beauty onto this particular woman. So I just want to say just a few sort of words about that. And these topsy-turvy views, the word that's translated as beautiful is shupa. We have our own beautiful shupa around the LBC. And shupa it does mean beauty, but it also means purity. So, I suppose the point here is that when we see, true beauty and real purity, we can't actually, according to the tradition, we can't apprehend that through our senses. Beauty is very, very important to be able to appreciate the natural world and each other, if you like. But true beauty is something of the mind. It's something of the higher mind. My strongest experience of this was on my ordination course. So we were 23 men together up a mountain, not really seeing very many others. Not really doing very much. We were doing a retreat, but we weren't, very, very simple life. And what I found was that I could just take delight in just being in nature, like sitting on a boulder for an hour, a real sense of beauty around me. Which was sort of beyond my normal lower mind, my normal sort of way of being. I mean, hopefully we get an experience of that just being on this retreat as well. Things just are more vivid when our minds are more concentrated and more positive. There's a lot more I can say about beauty. I'm going to gallop on to the next adventure and say something about the next topsy-turvy view, which is seeing the impermanent as permanent. Okay, so I'll give you another quote from the novel about Don Quixote's view of this particular area. So basically he's talking about, he's read somewhere in a tale of chivalry that there's a healing balm. So this is a healing tonic that you can drink, which has very, very good effects. And so this is what he says about this balm. And he's talking to Sancho, as he often does. "It is a balm, the recipe for which I have memorized, and with it one need not fear death, nor think that one will die of any wound. When I prepare it and give it to you, Sancho, all you need do, when you see in some battle that they have cut my body in two, as is wont to happen, is to pick up the part of my body that has fallen to the ground, and very artfully and with great cunning, before the blood congeals, place it on top of the other half, still in the saddle, being careful to fit them together precisely and exactly. Then you'll give me only two mouthfuls to drink of the balm I have mentioned, and you will see me sounder than an apple." So, I mean, again, it must be true. He's read it in A Tale of Chivalry. He's seen it in action. So, I mean, I've got the word here, madman, written on my piece of paper. So, yeah, so I think it's really interesting, an illustration of trying to circumvent impermanence, isn't it? And yeah, we can. It's sort of funny, but I do wonder whether we, well, what are our equivalents? You know, what are our healing balms? What do we use to try and get around impermanence? And there's a whole list of ways that we try and do this, I think. So, you know, think about things like pensions, relationship, property, career. I mean, it's almost like, you know, none of these things are bad in themselves, are they? But we can use them to try and circumvent impermanence. You know, we can use them to try and fix things, as though it's like as though we can sort of take out an insurance policy against things changing. So as I say, nothing wrong with those things in themselves, but it's like, what are we trying to use them for? You know, are we trying to use them in the way that Don Quixote is using them? I mean, I also think it's really interesting reflecting on impermanence, such a central Buddhist teaching, isn't it? But I do wonder sometimes whether we even use impermanence as a healing balm. So one thing I was thinking about this was, the teaching often comes out when things are going wrong, doesn't it? You know, it's quite interesting that, you know, we think, I think, this is a really difficult situation, I'm having a bad day, but actually it's impermanent, so, you know, it will change. But we're less keen to do that when things are going well, aren't we? You know, and I think that's sort of quite interesting. So I do wonder whether we can use impermanence as a balm to almost to sort of get around itself, you know. Another thought I have about impermanence and you know, how we reflect on it is, I think we often tend to emphasise the decay part of impermanence. So, you know, we often think impermanence means death, which of course it does, and it's a really good reflection to reflect on death. It's, you know, it's a very, very important reflection, I think. But the other side of impermanence is things arising. And again, I sort of wonder whether, there's a real fashion in our Western world for pessimistic nihilism. It's the word that came in our team meeting. Paul is holding his hands up. So, yeah, and I think the two go together. So, you know, emphasising the decay part of impermanence basically goes with nihilism, because we think, things just sort of fall away and there's nothing. You know, all values are relative, etc., etc. When we emphasise more the coming into existence of things, then that's a more eternalistic sort of way of thinking. The sort of two go together. Yeah, and definitely seems like for a lot of us, nihilism is, well, it's in the air, really. Materialistic view of the universe. So yeah, I think, you know, I think it's really good to reflect on impermanence in as fully as possible, both sides of it, because without the reflection on things coming into existence, it's very difficult to practice, isn't it? if we can't sort of think about ourselves as developing and growing, then, well, practice isn't possible, you know, without that positive side of impermanence and change. So yeah, there's a few thoughts about impermanence and this wonderful balm. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the next viparyasa, which is seeing the insubstantial as substantial. So just to say before this quote, Don Quixote has made some of this balm now in the story, and he's going into this adventure, and he's drunken some of this balm. So this is what happens in this particular adventure. Don Quixote saw a large, thick cloud of dust coming towards them along the road they were travelling, and when he saw it, he turned to Sancho and said, "This is the day, O Sancho, when the good fortune that destiny has reserved for me will be revealed. This is the day, I say, when, as much as on any other, the valour of this my arm will be proved, and I shall perform deeds that will be inscribed in the book of fame of all time to come. Do you see that cloud rising there, Sancho? Well, it conceals a vast army composed of innumerable and diverse peoples, which is marching towards us." "If that's the case, there must be two," said Sancho, "because over in the opposite direction there's another cloud of dust just like it." Don Quixote turned to look, and he saw that it was true. He was overjoyed, thinking no doubt that these were two armies coming to attack and fight each other in the middle of a broad plain. So he's absolutely delighted, as we've heard. These two armies coming together. Finally, he can show his valour, his courage. But what it actually is, these two dust clouds, is it's two flocks of sheep. So it's two flocks of sheep, and Don Quixote can't see this. And this is what happens. So basically, you know, he responds to the two clouds, and as fearlessly and courageously as if they really were his mortal enemies. And basically, these shepherds and herdsmen who are looking after the sheep, they try and get Don Quixote to stop. You know, they're shouting at him to stop and to see sense. And it just doesn't work, them shouting. So basically, seeing this had no effect, they unhooked their slings and began to greet his ears with stones as big as fists. So that's what happens to our poor hero in this adventure. So I was sort of reflecting on what is Don Quixote doing in this adventure. I think what he's doing, well, one thing to say about him is he means well. You know, he really does mean well. You know, he's not coming from a negative place. You know, he's very inspired. He's very ethical in a way. And he's responding with emotion, that's for sure. But what he's doing is he's seeing something that isn't there. You know, he's seeing these armies, and actually it's just two flocks of sheep. So he's basically, he's substantialising something. He's making something that's not there. The other thing I think he's doing is he's clearly taking sides. So he's thinking, well, these are two sides, and he's going to fight on the side of the good. So there's a few things, you know, a few ideas about what he's doing. And again, you know, it's really easy to laugh. I mean, I think it's mandatory to laugh actually at Don Quixote. But I sort of, again, I wonder. So, you know, do we do this? Do we sort of see things that aren't there? Do we sort of see two clouds of dust and put stories onto those clouds and take sides? I think it's very, very familiar. It's very, very, in a way, it's very, very normal for us to do that. And we do it in so many different ways, don't we? I mean, I think about, as soon as I think about my football team, you know, I'm working on this. But it's almost immediately tribal, you know, and that's what we're talking about, you know. I mean, politics is a classic example, isn't it? Somebody could say, you know, political... thoughts, and quite quickly we have our arms and we're in, sort of in the battle there. we just do this in so many ways. And again, I mean, it's quite natural and it's fine, isn't it? I suppose it's when we, when like Don Quixote, we become too rigid or we take these things too literally, as you know, literally existing oppositions that is a problem. You know, so I think that's the issue. I mean, it's very very natural to respond in the way that he's responding, but it's when we sort of take things to be absolutely real that it's an issue. This is a particular area for me. I put this under the category of identity, so that's one way I think about this. So, you know, my upbringing, as Maitreya Raja was saying a bit in the introduction, so I come from a mixed race family. My mum is English, my dad was Nigerian. And sometimes it felt like being at the United Nations or something, you know. So it's like, you know, I think harmony has been a big thing for me and my family. But also there's been something about, well, like, where do I fit in? You know, which group do I belong to? I've always been very, very sensitive to that. You know, sort of growing up in rural Norfolk as a, you know, a mixed race family. It's like I've been very, you know, I think we were probably all, me and my brothers were sensitive to like, where, you know, fitting in. It's very, very important, you know. What else to say? Well, I think the strongest experience I've had of this, as so often, was on my ordination retreat. I remember Manju Vajra, who was one of the leaders of the retreat, he said some really interesting things happen around the dining area. This one day I was walking towards the dining area, like we'd been, you know, on retreat for weeks. And I had this thought about fitting in or something. I was like thinking, well, I'm worried about how my brothers are seeing me or something like that. Like, you know, what are they thinking of me? And at that moment I realised it was something I was doing to myself, basically. It was a very, very strong habit that I was doing to myself of this sort of opposition. And it was just a small moment, but it was very, very interesting, and I haven't been able to sort of stay with it since, but, you know, I can remember it, and I think, well, actually, this is what I do with my mind. This is how I see the world in terms of, you know, me and others fitting in, identity, whereas actually, well, as Maitreya Raja was saying, Sangharaksha's teaching of individuality is really important, like trying to become an individual so that you're not reacting against a group, you're not trying to fit in, but you're, you know, you're yourself, you're a human being. So that's very important for me. So a few reflections about seeing the insubstantial as substantial, and, you know, how we do that in terms of groups and in lots and lots of different ways. And, you know, what follows from that as well. Wars, for example. Okay, so I'm going to say something about the final viparyasa, which is seeing the unsatisfactory as satisfactory. Basically, you know, when you act in the world, when we act in the world a bit like Don Quixote, when we see the ugly as beautiful, when we see the insubstantial as substantial, etc., it's only going to end one way, isn't it? It's only going to end one way. So this is a continuation of the battle that he's been involved in, so it's part of the same chapter. He's talking to Sancho Panza, and he says, "Come here and see how many molars and teeth I have lost, because it seems to me I do not have a single one left in my mouth." Sancho came so close that his eyes were almost in his master's mouth. By this time the balm had taken effect in Don Quixote's stomach, and just as Sancho looked into his mouth, he threw up more vigorously than if he were firing a musket. Everything he had inside, and all of it hit the compassionate squire in the face. "Mother of God," said Sancho, "what happened? Surely this poor sinner is mortally wounded, for he's vomiting blood from his mouth." But looking a little more closely, he realised by the colour, taste and smell that it was not blood, but the balm from the cruet, which he had seen him drink. And he was so disgusted by this that his stomach turned over and he vomited his innards all over his master. And the two of them were left as splendid as pearls. So I don't need so much about that, I don't think. I mean, is there any better image for dukkha in all of literature? Very unsatisfactory situation. I'll just leave that, I think. But actually, one thing to say is, a bit later on, like they're going on to their next adventure, and they meet someone, and basically Sancho introduces Don Quixote, and he gives him a new name. He says, this person they meet, he says, "This is Don Quixote de la Mancha. He is the knight of the sorrowful face, or the knight of the sorrowful countenance." And, after they sort of carry on for a bit, Don Quixote says, "Well, why did you introduce me like that?" And Sancho just says, "Well, you've got such a sad face, haven't you? You know, with all the different definitions of that word, you know." So he looks in a real state, you know. But once again, Don Quixote just is delighted with this new name. And he immediately thinks, "Well, I can get a shield made, you know, with a sad face on it." And it's like he seems to see it as a brilliant branding opportunity. You know? There's things to be said about that. About do we do that? How do we sort of view our misfortune? Do we sort of cling on to it? I mean, you know, it's sort of easy to say because the work of working through difficulties is really, really hard work, isn't it? And, you know, it's a big part of the path. You know, we all bring difficulties to the path that we need to work on. But yeah, I just think there's something interesting to reflect on there about, you know, what we do, what do we do with our difficulties? I don't know what to say more than that, but okay. So I'm getting to the talk part of the talk where I talk about the theme a bit more. So I just want to say a bit about pranya, paramita. I mean, hopefully it's obvious where I'm going with this. But yeah, I just want to contextualise it a bit with what we've been doing on this retreat. So we've been looking at the six paramitas: dana, generosity; sila, ethics; kshanti, patience; virya, energy; and then samadhi and pranya. And I was thinking, the first four, even the first five paramitas, are fine, aren't they? But they're not enough. They're not enough, are they? It's really interesting. Again, reflecting on Don Quixote, you know, he is an ethical man, as I say. He's certainly energetic. You know, he really sort of puts some welly into these adventures. I think he's probably quite patient. But what he doesn't have is, he doesn't have wisdom. You know, he has the opposite of wisdom. And that's the problem, you know. And so it's great practicing ethics. It's great practicing patience, and they do have a benefit in themselves. But as Buddhists, you know, we want to practice the whole path. And this is what Shantideva says about wisdom at the start of chapter 9. So this is the chapter on wisdom. He says, all of these practices were taught, so these are the previous paramitas, all of the rest of the book up to this point. All of these practices were taught by the Mighty One for the sake of wisdom. Therefore, those who wish to pacify suffering should generate this wisdom. So what he's saying is that all of the paramitas are there to try and gain wisdom. They're at the service of wisdom. We've had a strong emphasis on compassion, I think, I think one of the things I said when introducing this part of the retreat was the Mahayana tradition that Shantideva is part of. You know, compassion was very strongly emphasised, partly, I think, as a corrective to what had gone before. So the Mahayana critique of early Buddhism was that it become a bit self-referential or something, like we could gain enlightenment for ourselves alone, regardless of what's happening around us. So yeah, the compassionate side of Mahayana Buddhism is very, very strong and important, but the wisdom side is equally important. And as we probably know, you know, wisdom and compassion in Buddhism, they're not separate things anyway. They're part, you know, two sides of the same coin. So yeah, just to say a bit about the tradition that Shantideva was speaking to. So just as with compassion in early Buddhism, the Mahayana Buddhists were, I think, acting as a corrective to what had gone before in terms of wisdom. So what had happened was, the Buddha gave his teaching orally, and then, you know, 500 years after his death, his parinirvana, the teachings were starting to be written down. And then there was a great tradition called the Abhidharma, which Sangharakshita has talked of as like a big sorting out exercise. So all of the teachings just being sorted out so that, you know, they were more accessible or something like that. So there's this whole sort of scholastic tradition of the Abhidharma, big sorting out exercise. And towards the end of that process, it's like they did all this academic work, and they got to this point where they thought they'd got to these irreducible elements of our experience. So I can't remember, there's various lists. So the Abhidharma would say, well, there's 256 building blocks to our experience, and these are sort of irreducible elements. And that just goes against the original teaching, doesn't it? Because the original teaching of impermanence or insubstantiality. So the Mahayana came along and said, actually, no, it's not like that. No, everything is empty. Everything is based on conditions. There's nothing actually beneath, there's no building blocks, if you like. Everything is based on conditions. The Heart Sutra that we hear in the Puja is like a classic of this tradition. So the Mahayana perfection of wisdom tradition, where basically what it's doing is it's constantly trying to pull the rug from under our feet. As soon as we think we can settle down and think, well, this is real, it pulls the rug from under our feet. And it was in response to this this sort of rigid scholarly approach which had gone astray in the Buddhist tradition. The chapter 9 of the Bodhicharyavatara is like this as well. It's basically a long, difficult chapter. It's actually difficult to read because I don't think we can know the context for it, but basically what Shantideva is doing is he's taking arguments from different Buddhist schools around at that time and saying, actually, no. As a way of saying actually reality is, we can't sort of fix reality. Get to the stage where, you can't really talk about this stuff. That's the tradition that Shantideva is talking into. It's like a big corrective. And again, maybe for us, we can read it nihilistically as though, all of these negations, all of this saying no, it's just saying, well, actually, there's nothing. And what's the point? Again, it's not quite like that. Maybe for us, we need a dose of eternalism or something. Maybe we need to think of the Buddha as, still existing and worship the Buddha in that way. And there's been a bit of an emphasis on that in our movement recently. So it's really interesting, but that's what Shantideva was addressing, a sort of eternalistic fixed view, I think, that was around at that time. okay. And one thing to say about another thing to say about this is I just want to refer to the shrine. So this figure on the shrine, Manjushri or Manjugosha, is the Bodhisattva of wisdom. And there's a particular connection with Shantideva. So Shantideva was said to have a very, very strong connection with this figure, and even to receive teachings directly from Manjushri. So this Bodhisattva of wisdom. Another thing that I'm interested in actually is some of these perfection of wisdom teachings, like the Heart Sutra. That's eventually what. So things like Zen are came from that tradition as well. And I've been reading recently that some of the Zen teachings were the first that came into Europe and into the West as well. So it's in a way we're sort of part of this lineage, this sort of unfolding. So I want to talk a bit about what all of this might mean for us, and then conclude. But before that, I want to say just a bit more about Manjushri, just to sort of describe him. So he is youthful. He's 16 years old. He's holding a flaming sword above his head. So it's a sword of wisdom, sort of cutting through the veils of ignorance. And also he's holding a book to his heart. I think in this picture he's holding a lotus stem, and the book is sitting on the lotus of his shoulder. And again, the book is from the Pranyaparamita tradition, as the Heart Sutra is, the perfection of wisdom tradition. And it's the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines. So I think it's a beautiful image. We can maybe bring it to mind. Partly I wanted to mention it because there was a fantastic moment in the kitchen on the first part of the retreat. So we have our sort of youthful prince in our kitchen, don't we? And so I went in and saw Grant in the kitchen. I just sort of wandered out and then wandered back in again. And when I came back in, Grant had got this flaming knife and was taking it to the sink. We shouldn't tell the boss this, actually. I thought it was a brilliant moment. And afterwards, I thought, oh yeah, it's like Manjushri sort of manifesting. Maybe I'm getting carried away. Yeah. I mean, Grant didn't hold it above his head, so there's a bit more training to be done, I think. But no, I really love that moment. Anyway. So yeah, just to conclude, I just want to say, we can laugh at Don Quixote's blundering, but actually, some of these things are quite familiar when we reflect on them. You know, they're sort of closer to home. I think we laugh because they are so familiar. They are sort of how we go about our lives. Doesn't sort of seem like that from the inside, but you know, I think from the Buddha's point of view, or from Manjushri's point of view, that's what they would see us as, sort of Don Quixote type characters blundering through existence. And you know, it's like we wouldn't be judged, we're not judged for that, but it's just a shame that, you know, we have the teaching so close to us but sort of yet far away, and we get into all of our own particular individual scrapes, if you like. So what can we do about this? Well, we can try and practice paramitas to the best of our ability. Dana, Sila, Shanti, Virya, Samadhi. All as a sort of preparation for trying to see things as they really are. Mudita Shri talked about Samadhi yesterday, talked about meditative absorption. And this very, very traditional division, isn't there, between ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And, you know, so having a mind that is not feeling remorse, is not preoccupied by things that we've done, so that when we sit in meditation, we can really sort of see what's there. We can really have a clear enough mind to look at our experience and really try and see reality. There's also another definition of samadhi, which I think Mudita alluded to yesterday as well, where you can see samadhi as the end point as well, as a sort of wisdom in itself. And there's the three samadhis. It's another part of the tradition, and the three samadhis correspond to the marks of conditioned existence. So they're like gateways to freedom. So from impermanence, we can move towards the imageless samadhi, and you know, it's a gateway through to, I like to think of it as gateway through to the blue sky, infinite blue sky of freedom and enlightenment. From dukkha, there's the unbiased samadhi. So an image that's used there is, it's like a perfect sphere sitting on an infinite flat plane. So instead of being dragged around by our craving, hatred, and you know, the unsatisfactoriness of life, instead of, you know, trying to respond to that, well, the image is there. We're unbiased. We don't get pulled around. So that's the unbiased samadhi. And then there's the shunyata samadhi. So again, it's a gateway from insubstantiality to freedom. So yeah, I just want to leave you with that. I think the image for me is, I sort of talked about Don Quixote on my ordination course as well, and I taught the Don Quixote sadhana practice on that course. So a sadhana practice is a visualization practice. So you're given the Manjushri sadhana, for example, at ordination, and you visualize this bodhisattva of wisdom every day as a way of moving closer towards towards that quality. So maybe I'll just do that now to finish as well. I'll just initiate you into the Don Quixote sadhana. It won't take long. Okay. You can sit as you wish. You can close your eyes if you wish. So we just picture an infinite blue sky. Blue sky, infinite in all directions. Above, below, and on all sides of us. To the left, in the blue sky, we picture Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, 16 years old, very beautiful. To the right, we picture Don Quixote, middle-aged, weathered, scrawny. Manjushri holds a flaming sword aloft, the sword of wisdom. Don Quixote's sword is blunted, dented. Manjushri is adorned with jewels. Don Quixote wears mildewed, rusty armor. Manjushri's throne rests on four roaring lions. Don Quixote rests on four bleating sheep. Don Quixote has a lock of Dulcinea's hair in front of him. Manjushri holds the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines to his heart. Don Quixote holds all of the tales of chivalry. He drinks the healing balm. Very, very slowly, Don Quixote disappears into a cloud of dust. Manjushri becomes ever more radiant, ever more beautiful.